Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The question is, whatever happened to the city of St. Louis, Missouri, facing southern Illinois across a bend in the Mississippi River? Where did it go and why? The World's Fair of 1904 was its crowning moment. St. Louis was then the fourth largest city in the U.S., the emblem of America and where we were going. It was the 27th city in the title of Jonathan Franzen's breakout novel in the late 1980s. Today, on the list of cities by size, St. Louis is number 70. The Broken Heart of America is the title of one historian's fresh take on the fate of St. Louis. It was one of the most compelling books I read toward the end of 2020. It's a merciless self-examination of a city by a native son of Missouri, a sort of inquiry into a St. Louis condition that keeps showing symptoms over two centuries and more. Racial capitalism is the very short form of Walter Johnson's long diagnosis. He is tenured on the Harvard History faculty, but he wrote this book less as a professional historian than as a citizen, he says, measuring a history that has benefited him as a white man and a Missourian. So his story of St. Louis begins not just with the explorers Lewis and Clark scouting the Louisiana Purchase for Thomas Jefferson. It begins really with Walter Johnson's growing up.
Well, I think that beginning point is in Columbia, Missouri, where I grew up, which is about 2 hours to the west of St. Louis. And I suppose with a feeling of discontent and puzzlement and rage that I grew up with, recognizing that the stated values of my society, whether you mean the United States of America or my little social class in Columbia or the people in my church or whatever, seemed at odds with the material reality of the way that other people lived in my city and in the United States.
How did that dawn on you and when?
I remember being conscious of difference from a very, very early age, and certainly conscious of racism from a very early age. You know, that's the sort of thing that was ambient among young white kids in the public schools or in the schools where I went. I grew up in a household where that wasn't acceptable. I grew up with several close black friends, and so there was a little bit of attention that I was aware of from a pretty early age. And it took me a long time to understand both the historical and the economic aspects of that. And in a way, this book is part of that journey of discovery for me. So trying to really look at the historical depths and economic structures of racial capitalism in the place where I'm from.
Take apart this phrase, racial capitalism. In your story, it begins with Lewis and Clark, who were assigned by Jefferson to explore what he'd just bought from Napoleon.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to do with the notion of racial capitalism is to try to help people understand the way that the history of capitalism and the history of racism, the history of imperialism, have never been separable from one another, or at least not from the time of the Atlantic slave trade. And so to force people to imagine that their commitment to live in an anti-racist world, a world without racist difference, has to be at the same time a critique of capitalism. And likewise, to convince people that their critique of capitalism is one which must attend to the specificities of racial dispossession, extraction, and exploitation. Economic life was organized, justified, imagined racially. And certainly the notion of Lewis and Clark going up the Missouri River to survey territory that at that time is controlled by various Native nations for its economic output, particularly for the fur trade. You know, at every village they stopped at, they read a statement about the dominion of the United States and now how these people were part of the United States. And they did so really in confrontation with the existing reality, which is that they couldn't survive. They couldn't survive themselves. They survived the winter of 1804 in the Mandan villages, you know, out of the grace of the Mandan. And their navigation along the river was at every step based upon knowledge and information they had gained from the native people of the Missouri Valley.
Yeah, there was kindness among strangers in that period that you write about.
It was a rough and violent world, but it was a rough and violent world which was not at that point dominated by Anglo or French imperialism. There were a set of standoffs and compromises and middle grounds, none of which we would want to romanticize. And yet they were certainly different from what began to follow in the 1820s and 1830s. And what eventually happened was that fur traders in the city of St. Louis tried to and eventually successfully displaced Native Americans from the trapping and hunting aspect of the interchange that they had done and sort of effectively both whitened and proletarianized the fur trade.
There's an uncanny sort of process that emerges of control, removal, expropriation of the natives that becomes a kind of learning process for the management of slaves.
I think that's right. That puts it perhaps more directly than I do in the book, but I think there is a Western variant of anti-Blackness. And that Western style of anti-Blackness is based upon ideas of cantonization and removal. And so that it follows directly from the logic of Indian removal. Hmm. The practices are similar. And the notion of the white man's country emerges initially out of a confrontation with Native Americans and with Native American sovereignty, and then is generalized out to the presence of African Americans and particularly free people of color. Running underneath that is a contrast between the racial political economy of the West and of the South. Because the South is a, you know, the Deep South in particular, but really most of the South is a slave-based economy. And it's an economy which depends upon African American labor and African American reproduction. Many of those who migrate to Missouri in the years after the War of 1812, which is to say in the years when that part of the Midwest has been cleared of Native American resistance to the satisfaction of white migrants, many of those people really do not want to live next to slaveholders. They are non-slaveholding white people who believe that slavery gives slaveholders an unfair advantage in places like Virginia. And so they want to move out there and have it be a kind of a whites-only and, to their mind, more democratic society because they're not going to be subordinated to slaveholders. Many of these people are, at the very same time, anaphylactically upset about free people of color, who they believe will degrade their labor and compete with them for jobs. And so the first Missouri Constitution has a provision in it that forbids free people of color from entering the state. It's the Constitution that's at stake in the Missouri Compromise. And so there's an aspect of the Missouri Compromise, which is conventionally thought of as a conflict simply over the stretch of slavery within the United States. There's an aspect of that conflict over the Missouri Compromise that's actually about the freedom of free people of color to move to the state of Missouri. And so I try to trace those conflicting impulses between pro-slavery and a kind of a removalist white supremacy. The removalist version of white supremacy, the version that says we don't want slavery in the West and we don't want free people of color in the West, is the one that really emerges very strongly out of St. Louis and characterizes part of the war in Kansas and characterizes a lot of the politics of the Republican Party leading up to the Civil War and then after.
If you visit St. Louis today, I would say anybody feels that there's a story here that's not being told. A great deal of it is race, but it's also incredible power on the part of the city government to clear blocks, empty blocks, build blocks, assign people, move them. Again, there's an echo of the Indian history, but walk us around St. Louis today. The first impression is, even near Busch Stadium, near the Stan Musial statue, nobody's here. Where are the people?
Yeah.
This is a kind of key to what you're looking at.
That's right. You could read my book as the response of someone who had been to St. Louis many, many times before he ever actually went to St. Louis. I have relatives to whom I'm very close in St. Louis. We used to travel over there all the time. And when we went into the city, we took the sort of approved routes, the bypass routes. You go into St. Louis and you're immediately shunted on to a kind of a transportation infrastructure that is a remnant of the period of urban redevelopment, which in St. Louis meant the displacement of tens of thousands of African Americans and the reconstruction of the city in the service of the suburbs and in the service of the county and in the service of the white middle class. And so it took me a long time to learn different routes through the city and to see different places in the city and to find both all kinds of beauty and human flourishing in places where I had been, I don't want to say forbidden to go, but just places where there was a certain kind of anxiety that was produced among white people, you know, where I grew up or, you know, about the city, that I then found all kinds of beauty and, you know, flourishing and friendship in parts of the city where I had been told not to go.
I want you to take us there, not only for the vitality of today, but also for the history of how it got this way.
So the other thing that you see, of course, is a lot of endemic vacancy and a lot of torn down buildings. And so this long story that I tell is one of repeated racial removals. And, you know, that begins, as we were saying, with the Indian Wars of the 19th century, all of which before the Civil War were staged out of Jefferson Barracks. All the Western Indian Wars were staged out of Jefferson Barracks, which was in St. Louis and was the headquarters of the Western District of the U.S. Army. And then follow that up through what became an increasing pattern of the removal of African Americans from East St. Louis in 1917 and the race massacre, where anywhere between 3,000 and 5,000 of the Black inhabitants of East St. Louis never came back after fleeing across the pedestrian bridge to the city of St. Louis.
Coming up, the horror show in East St. Louis in 1917. Mob violence meticulously observed by Ida B. Wells. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. East St. Louis was an unregulated annex across the river in Illinois. In Walter Johnson's History of the Broken Heart of America, it's the company town that boomed in World War I and then exploded at the same time.
The thing about East St. Louis, it was a kind of a municipal wild zone for capitalist industrialists. It was a shell of a city, and it was designed as a shell of a city to be a place where corporations could locate businesses and be free of regulation.
Just to remind us, I think Monsanto, Alcoa, or predecessor corporation.
That's right. And then the stockyards with Armour and Swift and the railroads. What was happening in East St. Louis was a terrific environmental catastrophe, but also a catastrophe for working people, for working white people, and increasingly for working Black people who were coming up the Illinois Central Railroad from Mississippi and Louisiana to East St. Louis and to Chicago as part of what historians call the Great Migration, stopping in East St. Louis and looking for work. And that was a vexed hope for freedom because, you know, Du Bois says in, I think, the essay that he wrote about the East St. Louis massacre, which is called Of Work and Wealth, he says that one of the failures or the signature failure of the labor movement in the United States was the failure to recognize millions of emancipated African Americans as brothers in arms, to integrate them into organized labor and to make common cause with Black labor. That didn't happen in East St. Louis.
Has this been explained to this day, why white and Black workers, all of them oppressed in some fashion, couldn't see a common interest? And who prevented them from seeing it?
You know, Du Bois' Black Reconstruction is cast around that problem, this essay about East St. Louis, a lot of labor history. And I do think it is one of the essential tragedies of the history of the United States that white and black workers haven't made common cause. And I think that that really rests with, number one, the ability of oligarchs and plutocrats and wealthy capitalists in the United States to mobilize white supremacy as a way of making empty promises to white working people that prevent them from seeing that many of their interests, whether that would be in today's world, an interest in universal health care or in effective public schools or in less police or in prison abolition or in treating addiction as a medical and psychological problem rather than a criminal problem. All these things would be in the interest of all kinds of people in our society.
What was the interest, Walter Johnson, what was the interest of the white labor leadership in playing white against black?
For labor leaders, right, at that moment, it's a somewhat cynical way to mobilize their base. And so in 1917 in East St. Louis, we're talking about a situation where during the First World War, for the first time in a long time, organized labor has a huge amount of leverage, right? Because the plants have to be running 24 hours, and it's seen as a national security imperative to produce more and more in the aluminum ore plant or more and more in the stockyards. So all of those kinds of production imperatives give labor increased leverage. So at that moment, then, it is important for union leaders to, number one, try to limit the supply of labor by excluding black laborers from the labor market, and number two, to mobilize their base for a strike through kind of racist language about threats to our city, threats to our democracy, threats to your standing, threats to the, you know, your future in East St. Louis. So I think there's a certain amount of, well, there's quite a bit of that that goes into a strike at the aluminum ore plant, which is the precursor company of Alcoa. And management fairly predictably and completely cynically then brings in replacement workers, black workers, who the unions have failed to organize. So workers who have been excluded from the solidarities of organized labor. And that, I think most people would argue, is the final spark that touches off the massacre. In addition to the violence in downtown East St. Louis, which is the violence that was most chronicled in the newspapers of the day, there's the violence that was really, I think, uncovered and documented by Ida B. Wells in particular, but also to a certain extent by Du Bois. Part of the story there is just Ida B. Wells' extraordinary courage. She traveled immediately following the massacre, which was on July the 2nd, she traveled by train. During, you know, those days, the black porters on the trains were getting locked up in the bathrooms or in the freight cars going through East St. Louis out of fear. And the train stopped in East St. Louis. Ida B. Wells got off the train, but she had to walk across a creek that, from all accounts, was probably choked with dead bodies by herself, walking to the city hall. And then from City Hall started to travel out with black women as they went to try to pick up the possessions from their houses, which mobs of whites had looted and burned over the last couple of days.
Both of those writers, Walter, must be quoted. W.E.B. Du Bois on the origins of things and Ida B. Wells on the results of that moment. Du Bois had observed that white workers were conditioned to think of their whiteness as part of their property. And he says what they feared was not deprivation of the things they were used to in the shadow of poverty. It was, as you say, a boom time. Their fear was rather the death of their rising dreams. Whiteness as a commodity, almost. But then there's Ida B. Wells. Remarkable. She was there. She met a woman named Mrs. Flake. She had about $100 worth of furniture ruined, Ida B. Wells wrote. $50 worth of clothing, about $50 more of bedding, mattresses, and the rest. The mob had taken a phonograph for which she had paid $15 and 25 records for which she had paid 75 cents and a dollar apiece. She got away with her children before the mob reached her house, and she too came back that morning to get some clothes for herself and children. The mob hadn't left much, but out of the debris she was able to pack one trunk with some clothing and quilts for herself and children. It was in this house that I picked up one child's new shoe. Although we looked the house over, we couldn't find the other. In its spasm of wanton destruction, the mob had doubtless carried it away. Mrs. Flake also had life insurance policies for herself and children, but she couldn't find any of the books. She, too, had already found a flat in St. Louis and was only too anxious to get away from the town where such awful things were transpiring, and where not even widows and children were safe from the fury of the mob bent on killing everything with black skins.
There's part of me that just thinks that after that recitation, you just need to sit in silence and to think both about Wells' courage in going there and in this violence against women and children and against black domestic life and really against the possibility of a black future in East St. Louis. And that's why I will call this a massacre rather than a riot. And that's why I think that it fits in with the long history of Indian massacres. It was people burning down a house from one end and shooting people as they ran out the other end. And its final result was a kind of removal where all these thousands of people made their way, and moved to St. Louis.
We make connections also with Tulsa in 1919, and there were others. But in what sense are we talking about a template for the country, and in what senses are we not?
East St. Louis was the first of a series of horrible race massacres. I'm trying to make an argument that the things that became American history were intentionally exported from St. Louis as a hub. In this instance, I don't think I would want to try to argue that the kind of white supremacist technology of the massacre was invented in East St. Louis, but I think it's exemplary. It's exemplary of the history of a kind of racial capitalist removalism at that moment that I think follows through the other sorts of enormities of that period.
I'm trying also to think of exceptions to this pattern. For example, maybe Pittsburgh, a big industrial city with an important black population, a huge cultural center too, but also almost any city, including Boston, with a past, the past we don't talk about.
I mean, it's certainly more similar to some cities than to other cities, right? The city of St. Louis, the history is very similar to the history of Baltimore. It's similar to the history of New Orleans. Its present condition today is very similar to the city of Cleveland. I think there are ways that the similarities are more pronounced in some other cities. But I guess the thing I'd say is that I'm not sure there are cities in the United States that are exceptions to the effects of indigenous dispossession, slavery, coloniality, enclosure, extraction, exploitation. I mean, I think that is American history and the history of the relationship of American cities to hinterlands. There is a reckoning with the history of imperialism on this continent that has yet to happen. And is just beginning to happen. One could make the argument that the history of the relationship of northern cities to slavery, whether that's particularly New York, but Providence, that's an untold story or a story that we could stand to learn more about.
It's part of the fascination of your book, Walter Johnson, that just this question, why is it so hard to tell this story about what in St. Louis just immediately strikes you? Where are the people? What the hell happened here? And why has it been so easy to bury it?
In St. Louis, part of it is just the violence of the repeated dispossessions and removals. After the story of East St. Louis, I track the history of the city through at least two other huge removals. Removals that involved the destruction of hundreds of acres of the urban fabric of the city, the literal sort of historical erasure of the memory of black neighborhoods.
Tell the Pruitt-Igoe piece of the story.
I mean, I think you could argue that one of the stories of city development and population over the course of the 20th century is the story of subsidized suburbanization for whites and of public housing for African Americans. And Pruitt-Igoe was the largest and most famous public housing project in the United States, and perhaps is at this point still the most notorious public housing project in the history of the United States.
We had one smaller, but the same general idea, Columbia Point in Boston, outside into the harbor, might have been, felt promising when it was launched in the 50s.
If you imagine the end of the Second World War, and you imagine that human beings have been displaced and moved around on an unprecedented scale, and populations are being moved back and forth in Europe, you know, according to new national maps, and African Americans have been moved on tremendous violent scale in St. Louis already, there's a notion that there will be a kind of a spatial solution to this, and that it'll be a spatial solution that involves, you know, better sanitation and hot water. And there was a Missouri State Supreme Court case that said that public housing had to be integrated. And so there was a kind of a foundational white flight, a refusal on the part of the white inhabitants to make common cause with African Americans that was one of the tragic beginnings. You know, I mean, it may not be that the idea of building 33 11-story blocks over a couple of hundred acres was the best way of imagining human flourishing.
I was going to say, I mean, what were the alternatives to the spatial solution?
The spatial imagining, it wasn't humanist. There were no provisions made really for maintaining the property. As so many things in the United States have been in the history of the United States, there was an immediate kind of abandonment of those who moved into the project. And eventually, and really quite quickly, the St. Louis Police Department became the sort of way for the city to interact with its inhabitants, as well as eventually a number of intellectuals, sociologists. I suggested at some point there were more sociologists working in Pruitt-Igoe than there were maintenance workers. Mm. What I try to think through with Pruitt-Igoe is the way that Black people who had been dispossessed from neighborhoods in the city that were actually just torn down as part of a giant, gigantic, violent reconfiguration of the city in the image of the automobile and a certain kind of real estate capitalism, the way that they were converted into a resource for research, for sociologists. Mm. And then finally, and almost to me, at least unimaginably horribly, for the United States military, which did tests of airborne radiological weapons in the Pruitt-Igoe housing project in the early 60s, because the Pruitt-Igoe housing project to them was the closest spatial analog to a particular Soviet housing project that they were trying to imagine depopulating with weapons.
Wow, wow, wow.
Yeah. You know, I'm in a university, right? People say, oh, you're writing a book. Okay, well, what's the argument of your book? And at various moments, I would just want to say, the argument of my book is, can you believe this?
Oh, right?
Can you believe this? Now, that said, I will say that I was talking to one of my, I guess, one of my heroes in the city of St. Louis, Percy Green, who was a very radical, extremely effective Black activist in the 60s and 70s. And I mentioned to him and I said, can you believe this? And Percy Green's response was, well, yeah, I mean, that's how they do it.
He wasn't referring to military experiments at radiating a housing block, was he?
His level of history with the cynicism and violence of the white elite in the city of St. Louis led him to not be surprised by that.
Make the leap to Ferguson, the history, but also just the settlement, resettlement.
Ferguson is in what's called North County, so it's a part of St. Louis County. And one of the big underlying parts of the story is a hard and fast jurisdictional division between St. Louis City and St. Louis County. And that happened in 1876, and it shapes the history down to this day. So what that does is it makes it difficult for the city to capture new revenue by expanding its boundaries, which is what many American cities do. And it's part of the political shape of racial capitalism in St. Louis. Hmm. Over the course of the post-war period with the interstate highway system, with the FHA home loan guarantees, with the GI Bill, more and more working but increasingly middle-class whites moved out of the city. and move to the county. And so one of the reasons that the city of St. Louis seems so empty today is because so much of its population just moved to the county. The line between the city and the county was at one time a line between white and black, and was at one time a line between kind of an emerging suburban complex and a declining urban complex. That has been complicated by the reconstruction of the global economy. Much of the industry that moved out of the city to the county has now left Missouri and St. Louis entirely, but also by a long, hard struggle by African Americans in St. Louis to be allowed to move into the county at all. Now there is, I guess, what you might even call a kind of a corridor of African American settlement in what's called North County. So the St. Louis County directly north of the city, and Ferguson is one of those suburbs. Ferguson is a place that was, even through the 70s, not only majority white, but was you could argue, fiercely anti-black. One of the things that we haven't perhaps thought about enough in the United States is the way that many of the episodes of police violence, the hallmark episodes of police violence, occur in transitional neighborhoods. In a formerly white suburb like Ferguson, that is becoming a black suburb. You know, to some extent, that's the story of Ferguson, is a pattern of policing, which is trying to maintain a certain kind of rule, a white supremacist rule, in this case, a white supremacist rule partly in the service of corporate subsidy, and is encountering a change in population.
Coming up, inside the gloomy historian, it turns out there's also an inspired visionary. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. On the ground in North St. Louis, 6 years after the Ferguson uprising, our historian Walter Johnson sees active aspiration and an alternative model of city making.
Ferguson teaches us a lot about what racial capitalism looks like in the United States today.
Describe it.
I go through several aspects of the way that North St. Louis and North County look today. One of them is payday loans, right? One of them is this sort of for-profit policing. One of them are these tax abatements, which are justified based on the presence of impoverished populations, particularly Black populations. They're justified as a way of addressing urban blight, but they take the form of corporate welfare. And then finally, mass incarceration, which in the state of Missouri, as throughout the United States, basically targets urban African Americans and benefits rural whites who live in communities where prisons are built and maintained. All of these are ways of trying to extract wealth from a population, an African American population, that has been deemed surplus from the standpoint of production. For a long time in St. Louis, from really the moment of the Civil War all the way through the 1950s, there was a tremendous struggle to keep African Americans out of the labor market, right? That's what we're talking about in East St. Louis, is people coming up the railway line, trying to build a new life by getting a job in one of these stinking meat plants. And white people trying to keep them out of the labor market. And some of the most significant struggles in the history of St. Louis in the 40s, 50s, 60s, our labor struggles, efforts to get jobs in defense plants or as bank clerks or building the arch or working for the gas company. And the movement in St. Louis was really a economically focused movement. But as the economy, both in the city, you know, as the city economy moved to the county, and then the United States economy, production economy moved offshore, in a way, a lot of African Americans in St. Louis, like a lot of people in the United States, were marooned without jobs, without any hope of real employment. What's happening in Ferguson, as in many places across the United States now, is an effort to monetize those people, to extract wealth from them that's not based upon the exploitation of their labor.
I got to ask, why is it so hard to see? And it's not simple, and it's not just Missouri. I mean, how does a country deal with the worst embarrassments in its history, including the Indian Wars and slavery and Indian removal and so many things. It's our country and we love it, but these are the things that are almost impossible to put in the center of the picture.
You know, what I'm drawn to and what inspires me is something that Toni Morrison said about James Baldwin in her eulogy for Baldwin. She said that James Baldwin was the first person to have used the English language honestly.
Meaning?
He didn't euphemize. He didn't avoid. He spoke about things clearly as he saw them. And that, for me, is an inspiration. There are always people who believe, some of them in St. Louis and some elsewhere, that I speak too passionately about history. I'm too mean to, you know, I've got some criticism because I'm too mean to Abraham Lincoln when I call him a settler militiaman, that I should be more respectful of Abraham Lincoln because he was, you know, he was a visionary and he had all these complicated feelings about liberty.
He was surely more than a settler militiaman. And he was also, I mean, it's one little bone I'd pick with your story. I mean, the emphasis on the recolonization of Black Americans in Africa, that was a very minor ploy in his life, it seems to me, and in his story.
He was an architect of the United States Empire and of Indian removal, and he was a member of the Illinois State Militia. And
but that's almost a classic question of, do we let that part of a man's story obliterate the rest? Do we tear down those monuments?
What I would say is that we have ignored that part of the story. Hmm. We have ignored the imperial predicate of American freedom. And that if we speak honestly, we immediately recognize that the Homestead Act, which is taken as a tremendous achievement, is an enormous act of imperial violence, genocide, and expropriation. We have to think differently about...
Give us a year on the Homestead Act.
1863, hmm. Which basically says all the land, you know, to the west is going to be controlled by the Union, is going to be opened up and given away to white homesteaders.
In what sense is the teenager Walter Johnson still working out the contradictions that he can see between the euphemisms and what his lion eyes tell him?
I have a very good friend who's an activist and artist from St. Louis, and he said, well, you know, look, the book's called The Broken Heart of America, but really isn't this just a book about your broken heart? And that to me helped me understand a little bit more about some of the rage that's in the book, which is not only rage at the circumstances of my upbringing and of the upbringing of so many others in the United States, but also at my inability to understand it fully and see through it at different moments. And so I think that perhaps some of the emotional energy is about both my own sense of disappointment and hurt and misunderstanding of the place that I grew up, but certainly also of my own sadness and shame and rage at having not realized earlier or resisted more vigorously.
Does rage write great history?
I think, honestly, a lot of the things that I'm writing about, if you tried to write about them without rage, that would be outrageous, so to speak. Mm. I mean, if you really, you know, if you're talking about airborne testing, airborne radiological weapons testing on people who live in a public housing project, I mean, how are you not going to be enraged?
And the results, we have to say, did show up in their blood.
In their teeth, right, in their teeth, and do to this day in St. Louis. I mean, I have an aunt. My aunt grew up in Pine Lawn, Missouri, which is right outside the city boundary. It's a place where at one point there was the largest small arms production plant in the world was in Pine Lawn. Robert McCulloch, the prosecutor, was from Pine Lawn, and my aunt grew up with Robert McCulloch and remembers seeing these trucks. This was in an airborne radiological weapons test prior to Pruitt-Igoe. But seeing the trucks and the station wagons go around the city, you know, with sort of this kind of uncanny iridescent fog coming out the back and the kids running out to play in it. Hmm. She has, at this point, I think, had breast cancer and thyroid cancer. I probably shouldn't be talking about my family's medical problems on the radio. And she, you know, you go into a doctor in St. Louis and they say, well, did you grow up in one of these neighborhoods? Right. This is knowledge that is known.
Take us to the end of your book, which is almost euphoric, walking through North St. Louis and feeling a different culture emerging.
What I see a lot of in St. Louis are different kinds of visionary, radical projects of people helping one another, of people re-envisioning the city, people doing small, experimental, beautiful things that to me are ways of building the foundation for a better society. And that's really the way that I try to portray them.
Describe your choicest projects, Walter.
So, I mean, some of the things that I've been most struck by are the, you know, just as far as engaging in a different kind of relationship with the city is a project run by Dean Nichols and a couple of other designers. They did a sort of a send-off for a building that was being demolished. They painted a warehouse that was going to be torn down gold. And then when the warehouse was torn down, they took the gold bricks around and they repurposed them by giving them out to different community organizations that applied. And, you know, one built a stage for kids and one built a memorial to a particular corner in Black St. Louis that had been forgotten. These are small things unless you see them as efforts to try to, on a very, very immediate humane scale, to rework the architecture of the city into one that is not an architecture of Black dispossession and police control, but it's an architecture that celebrates both the history and the flourishing of Black St. Louis. I write at the very end of the book about a track team run by a woman whose son was shot by the St. Louis police, killed by the St. Louis police. And little kids, many of whom have people in their family who are victims of gun violence. This team practices at Normandy High School, outdoors. This is, again, on the north side. Michael Brown's high school. Michael Brown went to Normandy High School. And the kids will come, and the track team doesn't have to recruit because kids will just stop at the fence and watch and look what's going on. And then eventually they'll make their way over and join the track team. It's, again, a you know, underfunded, not aligned with any school or project, but just a way of people taking care of one another.
You just wonder, is this a completely new standard of what's interesting, what's powerful, what changes life?
Well, what I'm interested is in some sense, people who have begun to live lives that are not determined by Monsanto, or by the city of St. Louis, or by the state of Missouri, or indeed by the United States of America. What people in St. Louis are doing right now is they're saying, well, we're right here and we're right here with you. So why don't we together do something different together? And let's see where that takes us and let's see what we can do. To me, that's inspiring and instructive. It's something that I learned from watching people I admired, watching them move in the city and what they did after Ferguson. Right.
Yeah.
So whether, you know, some people after Ferguson and particularly people who weren't from St. Louis, you know, left the city and got involved and got national platforms. And some people stayed there and tried to take care of little kids who need coats or tried to do political education. You know, I'm thinking particularly about Tef Poe and Hands Up United or Kayla Reed and Action St. Louis. They tried to focus on closing the workhouse, closing the medium security prison in St. Louis, where 90% of the people on the inside are in there because they can't pay bail. And that to me is, for whatever reason, what I find compelling and inspiring.
Bring some of the connections here home. The history, the exceptional history, the denial history, the revisioned history, Ferguson, Tef Poe, activism, new politics, Cori Bush. Can you get all those notions into one sentence of what happened and where we're going, including the revisioning of our own history?
The long history is the history of the relationship between imperialism and racial capitalism in the history of the United States. And so one thing that I'm trying to do is to connect our present world to a very long history of dispossession, expropriation, and exploitation. The existing mechanisms that we've come up with to address those problems have proved over and over again insufficient. And many of them have been revealed to be parts of the problem themselves. The things that I come to at the end of the book are what people I think would call, you know, abolitionist solutions. They are visionary projects that are being pursued by people outside of the kind of imperative to seize state power and outside of a kind of a market-based set of calculations of value, the value of space or the value of people. I've been profoundly influenced by a man in North St. Louis called Sylvester Brown, who was a producer of the great documentary called The Pruitt-Igoe Myth and was a columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch for a long time. I heard him give a speech at one point. He said, people say we're poor, but look at our children. We're rich. Right. So to see the beauty and the potential and to learn from that, I think helped me think about politics and the future in a different way.
I can read your book as a sort of very, very high level manual of introspection in cities and communities all over this country, including our own fair city of Boston. I mean, who runs things? Who decided that the Irish would be in South Boston and the Italians in East Boston, for example, and they were for a century? And that's a bare beginning. But who calls the shots? What does industrial development have to do with it? Federal grants, even to this day? What's going on here at a more satisfying level?
You know, George Lipsitz has this fantastic little thing he does with audiences. He says, right now, I'm going to give you the greatest two research tools for understanding your society. And, you know, everybody waits and they think it's going to be, I don't know, some database or something. And he takes off his shoes and he says, here they are. Walk around, look, talk to people, listen to eyewitnesses. And I do think that the idea of walking down a street, whether that street is in Boston or the streets in St. Louis or it's in Fresno, and just realizing that the things that are there and the people that are there and the quality of the air and the noise and the vulnerability to premature death or to incarceration or to police violence.
And the loan shops.
And the payday loans or the, you know, the Dean and DeLucas and whatever.
Simon Sharma calls it the archives of the feet.
Terrific. Terrific. It's not accidental. And I think that our municipal politics are, at least to me, completely arcane. All of these different financial instruments and tax abatements. I mean, it took me, I'm still anxious that I haven't entirely figured out the way that the finances of the city of Ferguson work, right? And that's just one tiny little city in St. Louis County. But it took me months to understand the instruments and the way they were moving money around. And so I do think that there's an imperative to try to demystify that and to make it transparent, then people will be able to understand it differently. If I explain tax increment financing to some fairly conservative relative I meet at a family gathering, they think it's outrageous. They think it's just as outrageous as I do. And so I think there's a little bit of demystification that will actually help people understand politics differently.
What if the price of that daring, as W.E.B. Du Bois put it, is the death of our rising dreams?
You mean in the sense of that we have to set aside notions of American chosenness and aspirational accounts of the meaning of the United States?
And yeah, not to mention fame and fortune.
I think that's where we got to go. You know, in fact, I don't think that we have any other choice, to be perfectly honest with you. I don't think that, you know, amidst the 4 years of the kind of farcical Trump melodrama, I think that we have sometimes lost track of the fact that actually our common future depends on one another. And whether you think about that economically or you think about that environmentally or politically or morally.
Even medically.
I think that that's a reckoning that needs to happen. You know, it's needed to happen long since.
Walter Johnson, thank you so much for covering a lot of ground. Next time you're going to North St. Louis, I'd love to come along.
All right. There's some real sights.
I'd love it. Thank you for your work. Thank you for this conversation.
No, thank you. You have a good new year.
Support Open Source, please, by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you'll find a growing audio library of conversations about literature, politics, and lots more. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks. Mary McGrath is our visionary activist. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.